welcome to Walking the Field here. My name is Gerald Hopkins. I have my good friend with me, Alex Crow. We've gone through the Sweet 16. We're in the Elite Eight. And one of the themes, I know Alex can agree with me today, is the Pac-12 when it comes to basketball has been the conference this year. So we needed to bring someone in who watched one of the guys who knew the Pac-12 was going to be good, Bill Walton, right? So he brought in one of his counterparts, Stephen Hopkins, my dad. I have so many things I can intro you with, but I know if I get too in-depth, he'll make fun of me, so I have to be very careful about how I do this. We're recording from home on Zoom, which means I got to go home, so I must have done something right. My old man, thank you for popping on. Anything you want to do and make fun of me before we start for real?
Well, the only reason you got to come home is because of your mother, but, you know, I feel like I've got to use, like, big, spectacular words like Bill Walton, but, you know... And seeing being one of the guys who saw Bill Walton play, I could probably explain that a little way before your guys' times. But no, it's a real pleasure. It's a real joy to be on this. I'm honored.
So yeah, no, us and Alex's dad, the two listeners of the podcast have now joined us. We are more than excited. So because I brought my old man on here, the first game we have to talk about, the only game I didn't get to see because I was driving home. The 8 seed Loyola Chicago taking the loss to the number 12 Oregon State Beavers 58-65. I didn't get to watch this game. I don't know much to say about it. I don't want to talk about a game I didn't watch. You two take a hold of it however you feel.
I don't know. Basically, and Alex, jump in whenever you want here. I just thought that the big difference in the game was Oregon State's size got to Loyola. They were able to, in many regards, tip a lot of passes, bust up there. It's a very good defensive game, to be honest with you. And Loyola didn't play all that bad. It's just Oregon State played really well. And the other thing too, and as much as basketball coaches want to make life complicated and all overanalyze, you know, it's simple. You got to hit a few shots, and Loyola wasn't hitting any shots. I mean, that's, you know, you beat the guy by putting more balls in the basket. Loyola just was not shooting very well. And not that Oregon State did, but I mean, I contribute that to their defense. But, you know, Loyola's shooting percentage was, I think, was 20% at one point in time and stuff like that. I don't know the stats in front of me, but it was not. If I were to look at a shot chart, you'd see a lot of blank shots, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, because I have the stats pulled up. Yeah, for the game, only 18 made field goals for the Ramblers in that ball game. And it's something that I think that we're going to talk about a couple of times as we go through the games really from this weekend. You saw a lot of teams really struggle on offense. And much like we saw, you know, Steve, you and I and Jerry talked on the phone last week in that Illinois game about how Loyola Chicago did such a good job of preventing Illinois to run their offense, and everything about Illinois' offense was run through a high ball screen, which Loyola defended very well. And this one, you could tell that Oregon State did a great job in their week to prep for Loyola Chicago. You didn't see a whole lot of backdoor cuts, and that was a lot of Loyola Chicago's offense, is the movement off the ball. Oregon State was very locked in defensively, and like you said, they didn't shoot particularly well either, only 40% from the field, but they didn't turn the ball over, and they played great defense on the best defensive team that was in the tournament from a points per game standpoint given up.
Yeah, in total agreement there, Alex. You know, I can't underestimate, like I said, the size. You know, when you're coaching, and one of the things that Loyola didn't have is they have smaller guards. Oregon State, one of the things I learned when I got a chance younger in my coaching career to meet Rick Pitino and see one of his practices, he would stat tips in a practice, how many deflections are in a practice, things like that. I think if you were to go back at that Oregon State, the amount of deflected passes they got, where Loyola was a real timing sort of offense and those backdoor cuts were really needed precise passing, they deflected balls or did those things. And those little things, that size of Oregon State, and their front line was much bigger. I think that's what really took away a lot of the Loyola's ability to do what they had done against Illinois, which was not as big as those guys. You know, it's hard when you're six two going against a guy 6'6". It's that 4-inch difference, and it makes big differences in a lot of games, you know.
And I think that's a perfect transition to the next game that we're going to mention up here, because that's what Syracuse lives on, right, is this length and the idea of tipping passes, being in the lane with their 2-3 zone. but did not really help when you could not score the ball. The number 11 Syracuse Orange only scored 46 points in their loss to number 2 Houston. The Cougars came out. They're now in the Elite Eight. They also, I think, played tonight. I'll double check that as we go on through the podcast. But Alex, last week you made a point while we were talking about this, that Syracuse recruits to the 2-3. And we've talked about the Syracuse 2-3 probably more than Jim Boeheim does at this point. And one thing you said that stood out to me was they do a great job of recruiting to that, and they figure out the offense later. And I was reading a quote, and I was reading The Athletic, and this quote from Sam Venisi really summed up, I think, what we were both talking about. And here's how he ran it. Because the program has always had draft prospects, I talk to a lot of assistants about Syracuse every year. And while the defense tends to be more famous, we often talk more about the offense, particularly about how little Syracuse runs. The Orange don't run many plays, and they don't run intricate sets. The only guy who gets consistently gets a screening action run for him off the ball is Buddy Boeheim. Sometimes jokes are made about how easy it is for coaches assigned to scout prep for Syracuse. That was all from Zanfinisi. In an article, he wrote about how Syracuse always makes it to the Sweet 16. That really bit Syracuse in this game, right? You can see look at the point percentage. Yeah, 46, you know, or points in the whole game, 46. Not a lot. But they had nothing that was working against the Cougars. I think part of it was just that you didn't have a set to go to. You had guys who could score on that team. But when you're just setting a back screen here and there, figuring it out as you go, it's pretty easy if you don't like you don't have that one play or move to go to. And it felt like that game really came down to the fact that even though Syracuse only let up 62 points, yeah, nothing falling. Do you guys see anything totally different?
One thing that I really noticed in the Syracuse game is kind of like what happened with Loyola Chicago and their game against Oregon State. They just got out-athleted by Houston. I mean, you saw, you know, again, with guys like Joe Girard and Buddy Boeheim, they're not the most athletic guys I've ever seen in my entire life, and they just could not get free from Houston. And that's something you're going to see pretty much anytime Houston plays. I mean, Houston – in terms of teams that are still in the tournament, they are the best defensive team and they're the best offensive rebounding team. And as any coach, you know, Steve, I'm sure that you've probably said this before, what travels? Defense and rebounding. That travels with you wherever you go. Sometimes the shots aren't going to fall, but if you play defense and you rebound, you typically do that every game. And you just saw Houston just suffocated Syracuse, which is usually what Syracuse does to the other team. Again, especially in the tournament with the 2-3 zone. But when you rebound as good as Syracuse, as Houston does, they grabbed 11 offensive boards and were able to convert most of those into points. That was really the difference in the game. Syracuse just could not free themselves from the Cougars.
Well, and that, and I want to make sure I'm saying his name right. Calvin Sampson's the head coach at Houston. He's kind of fallen under the radar. He's an excellent coach. I mean, he was a great coach at Oklahoma. He got caught into some what we would say minor stuff at Indiana, and he was been kind of a pariah underneath that. He went to the pros a little. But, you know, people have underestimated his ability to coach. He's an excellent basketball coach. This is, you know, and he got the athletes, as you said, Alex, to kind of play his kind of style of game. But, I mean, yeah, Sampson is not, you know, give him a lot of credit. He is an excellent, you know, Houston's got a really good coach there with them. I mean, like you're saying, he has a little bit of a checkered past in college basketball, but the guy's won wherever he's gone. And I was not surprised that he handled Boeheim's 2-3 zone that hard, because the guy's been around the game. It's 2-3 zone's easy to pick apart if you have the right people. You know, Jerry, you know, knows that. I mean, you know, get the ball in the middle and you'll be successful against the 2-3 zone, you know.
It's almost like I've said that on a podcast before here, but one of the things too that, and if I remember correctly about Sampson, the thing that they caught him really on was calling a recruit too much, which now feels like nothing. If we're going to talk about coaches with checkered passes, right? Sampson's one of like the lightest checkers ever. I could probably, you know, like, I'm not sure if I could run a full game of checkers with his problems. Like, and that, it's just with me, I felt like you had no situation for Syracuse just to score a bucket or two when they needed them to, because they suffocated Buddy Boeheim, and the guy who was supposed to step up, as Alex said, was Joe Girard. It took him forever to finally hit a couple of shots, but when they did it, it was like, all right, now we're cutting the lead to 12, not 4, not 6, right? Just to the point where it's like again, you only gave up 62 points. That's not bad, but you didn't even score 50. And that's what killed this, the great defense by Houston. Anything else before we move to probably the best game of the Saturday run?
Well, I would just say, you know, if Houston makes it to the Final Four, it doesn't surprise me. Again, Sampson, I think, is an underrated coach. And I just think he's got kids playing his kind of game. And I think that's – wouldn't be surprised at all, you know.
Yeah, and if we want to go ahead and talk about that game, since we've already talked about both teams with Oregon State and Houston, I think Houston, you know, you look at all the rest of the teams in the tournament, you could argue that they probably have the easiest path of all of the higher seeds, I guess you could say, being that they're playing the number 12 seed in Oregon State. And that one, that's going to be another, I think, really gritty defensive game. Not a lot of points are going to be scored. You know, I saw like the Fox Super 6, they were saying, which game do you think is going to have the most points? I don't think it's going to be this one. You know, it's not going to be – you know, the team that, as far as teams still left in the tournament, Houston gives up the least amount of points per game. I think the only team that they're behind in the country is Loyola Chicago, and they're not behind them by a lot. So that's going to be a real battle. That game is tonight at 6:15 on CBS, and that's going to be a heck of a game. It's going to be, you know, which team's able to get baskets, because both of these teams, long and athletic, and are really going to make you work on defense.
Absolutely. We're talking a lot about defense. Let's run it to probably some good offenses, right? And a perfect example of this, the number 3 Arkansas Razorbacks pulling out a tight win, 72-70, against the Cinderella Oral Roberts. And man, did Oral Roberts give the Razorbacks a game. Absolutely down to the wire. Something to keep in mind, Alex, you didn't believe me when I said Oral Roberts shot a lot of threes. How about I give you the number of threes they shot? 31 in that game. They made only 8, but they shot 31 threes in that entire game. And what kills, and Coach Mills from Oral Roberts made this great point. You know, they lose by 2 points, and he had one technical in this game, the third of his career. Here's the quote he gave, which really, you kind of almost made my heart feel sad as a coach's son. "The game, losing is totally my fault," Mills said. "I've gotten 3 technical fouls, including tonight's, in my entire career. To get a technical foul when you lose by 2, it's a tough pill to swallow." Now, am I going to sit here and be like, Coach Mills lost Oral Roberts' game? No. Absolutely not. But it is a great point to think about. That is literally those 2 extra points that, instead of shooting the 3 and getting down court in 4 seconds to try to win the game, you know, to win or just get a tie, you're going for the win or you're going into overtime. But man, the biggest thing I could say about this is, one, I was not really impressed by Arkansas, but I don't know if I'm not impressed by Arkansas because Oral Roberts played so well or because Arkansas wasn't on their top form.
Well, let's not pretend like Oral Roberts did not play a heck of a tournament. And I mean, again, had a great shot at the end of the ball game, had, you know, arguably the best player. I mean, not arguably, he was, from a points per game standpoint, the best player in the country. And Max Asemus taking the last shot, got an open 3-pointer. It just didn't fall. Oral Roberts gave Arkansas all that they could handle in this ball game. And, you know, as someone who has picked Baylor to win the NCAA tournament in our bracket that's posted on Twitter, I definitely agree with you. I think that Arkansas, it'll be interesting to see how Arkansas plays against an elite defensive team like a Baylor, like if they were to beat Baylor, like a Houston in the Final Four, which is who they play. Those 2 games, Baylor and Arkansas and Oregon State and Houston, will match up whoever wins those games that are both tonight. Because Arkansas, really, I don't feel like has played a ton of great defensive teams. I mean, granted, they did play Texas Tech, who can really defend, and we're able to squeak out of there with a 2-point victory. But I'll be very interested to see how they're able to get shots, how they're really going to get shots to fall against another elite defensive team in Baylor, who especially does really well with one-on-one guarding.
Yeah, I agree with you, Alex. The thing about this, though, Musselman comes from a great family of coaches. His dad was a great coach, and he's just finding a way to win. You know, I some teams just have a mojo. And Arkansas is not doing it pretty, but they're winning. And you know, they're getting guys doing the right things. I like their guards. Their guard play is, they're quick. And I think that's the one thing. Baylor, I will have the athletes to go with them. But I think I would go, you know, the difference in that game for me is, what's Baylor's front court going to do against Arkansas, and what is Arkansas's guards going to do against Baylor's backcourt? I think that's really going to be the game right there in terms of how those two go in. Yeah, Baylor's, you know, 9-10 deep. He's a phenomenal, the guy at Baylor's a phenomenal coach. His dad coached in Valpo over here for years. And it's going to be a real fun game to watch. There's some definite, you know, there's, it's going to be, that's going to be a very athletic game to watch.
Yeah, and we can, I guess, go ahead and talk since we're already talking about Baylor. They, of course, were able to win their Elite Eight matchup as well. They were able to knock off Baylor, or excuse me, they won their Sweet 16 ball game against Villanova. And again, it was just a really gritty game. But, I mean, I want to talk about just for a second Davion Mitchell, because I have not gotten to watch just a ton of Baylor games this year, or at least watching them really closely, but I did in that game against Villanova. And in terms of just one-on-one, just man-on-man athleticism defending, I'm not sure that I've seen at the college level a guy who can move his feet as quickly as Mitchell. Not just a straight-line runner, but the way that he's able to slide his feet and stay in front of people is nothing short of incredible. You add that, you know, he also paced them in points against Villanova. But the thing that I like the most about Baylor, aside from their defense, is that they've got a lot of guys who can carry them when it's getting, when the going gets tough. I mean, like I said, it was Mitchell in the last game, and then you had Flagler chipping in with 16 points off the bench. In the previous game against Wisconsin, and a Wisconsin team that was knocking down some shots, knocked down 8 3-pointers, who was it coming off the bench to lead them? It was Matthew Mayer, a guy who, you know, doesn't even play a ton of minutes, plays maybe 15, 20 minutes a game during the season, just a guy who's just first to the floor hustle guy who gets a lot of rebounds. And the fact that Baylor is not super reliant, because right now their best player is not playing great basketball. I mean, Jared Butler, from a shooting standpoint, I mean, you look at just his most recent game against Villanova, 4 for 14 from the floor, 1 for 9 from three. And the fact that they've been able to win these games against solid teams like Villanova and Wisconsin without him really making an impact, that just speaks to the depth of talent, I guess you could say, for Baylor, because they've been playing, again, not even their best basketball, and they're still finding ways to win these games fairly comfortably as well, as they knocked off Villanova by 11.
And it felt like Villanova was missing one guy. Oh wait, they were. They're missing their best player in Colin Gillespie. That has been the key of the tournament, why a lot of people thought they were going to lose in the first round, but still, I think it's going to be a great coaching battle, right? My dad was kind of getting into it earlier. You got Eric Musselman versus Scott Drew, two great coaches that kind of play the same way. But for me, both these teams did not impress me that much in their earlier round of 32 or their Sweet 16 going into Elite Eight game now. Like, Baylor's been pretty good, and right, Jarrod Butler not playing his best, which makes this a lot harder to, like, really get a sense of how they're playing. But, like, I'm not confident in both teams right now by the last game they played, which almost makes this game better for me. Like, these are two teams that both didn't have the greatest game, but now you have a chance to really duke it out. I love the matchup here. This is going to be a fun, fun game. I'm really excited for it. Anything you want to add in this, where we look at this Baylor-Arkansas game?
Well, I thought Alex made a great point last week, you know, in one of us two listeners, that, you know, you start looking at, when you get to these type of games, it's really the athletes. And I just think Baylor's just got more athletes than Arkansas. And I think that may be the factor in that game.
And you also can't forget, because again, they haven't necessarily shown it the last couple of games, and especially in their most recent game against Villanova, but you're still looking at the best three-point shooting team in the country from a percentage standpoint. They're shooting 41%. You can't just count on them to shoot 3 for 19 again, especially a team against a team like Arkansas that's not particularly good on the defensive end from just guarding the percentage standpoints. They're a team that's going to get you into a shootout. That's kind of how they play, a lot like Alabama, where it's like the advanced metrics have them as a pretty good defense. But when you look at how fast they're playing, I think that if Baylor is able to get out early and make some shots, they could put Arkansas away very quickly. But again, you look at the individual scoring talent on Arkansas, and it's going to be the matchup of those guys, like a Moses Moody versus a guy like Davion Mitchell. That's going to be the whole thing. And Steve, I think you made a great point. The biggest question mark, I think, on the side of Baylor is their front court play. With guards and wings, they can guard with anybody pretty much 1 through 5. But it's going to be Thamba and then Chamwa Chachwa. I think those are going to be kind of some key impact players for Baylor and how they're going to be able to keep a super athletic Arkansas team off the glass.
Yeah, it's going to be a fun one to watch. Well, Alex, you know, well, let's talk about the next game while the host is going to. All right, Gonzaga gets USC. You know, I just think Gonzaga is the cream of the crop here. They can beat you from the outside. They can beat you from the inside. They got a great point guard. I don't see. But USC's got the Mobley brothers, and that could be a wonderful game. But I just think Gonzaga's just got too many weapons. You know.
I really agree with you, because again, you just look 1 through 5. There's not a lot of teams that can match up with a squad like Gonzaga, because inside you got Timmy, played basketball in Texas. He's from Richardson, and he was great in high school. I mean, they had Ball's Life South down at his basketball games pretty much on a weekly basis. The guy can flat out play. He's got that horrible handlebar mustache. But, I mean, the guy can play. He gets rebounds. He scores 22 points against an overmatched Creighton team. And Gonzaga has just put people away in this tournament early. They lead the country, of course, in scoring margin, easily outscoring all of their opponents en route to an undefeated record. But USC matches up not terribly against them. I wouldn't say it's a great matchup, but they've got two big men in the Mobleys, as you mentioned, that can kind of match up potentially with Kispert as well as Timmy. This will be a tough game for Timmy. This is probably the best, some of the best competition that he's faced from a defensive standpoint so far in the season. So that'll be interested in. That'll be an interesting one for me, but it's going to really hinge on the fact of whether USC is going to be able to knock down shots like they did against Oregon. 10 for 17 from the three, shot 58% from the field, just generally speaking. If they're able to bring that same sort of energy here against Gonzaga, because that's really the only knock on Gonzaga, is they're a solid defensive team, but they're not a Houston and they're not a Baylor. Their way of beating you is that we're going to put up 90, 95 points, and you're just not going to be able to keep – you just can't make shots to keep up with us. I think that if USC, they're going to want to try and slow this game down, make this a half-court game, and try and use their size with Isaiah and Evan Mobley, see if they can get some shots blocked, keeping Gonzaga off the glass. USC is a solid rebounding team because they've got all these athletes. And if they can find a way to keep knocking down threes like they have in the past couple of games, they could make this interesting. But I'm with you. I think the Gonzaga just too much firepower. I think that until they play a team really like Houston or Baylor or a team like that, I'm not sure they're going to get beaten.
Well, I like the length of USC a lot in the limited time that Gonzaga has to prepare for USC. That is the one thing that makes me very curious about this game, is the shortest player on USC's roster is 6'1". And like, that's not, you know, you'd be like, oh wow, that's a useless stat. The other guy's six, there's one guy at 6'2", and it just goes like way huge from here. 6'8", 6'6", 2 7-footers, right? Like, there are guys on that team that length makes it so much harder for a team like Gonzaga, who's good at in and out. And I like Gonzaga a lot, right? I've claim my praise for Jalen Suggs, especially. I love his game. I think he's fantastic. But like, if there's any team that's going to catch a Gonzaga off guard, that it's going to be a USC just because of length. That's a team that could cause havoc because they're so long and annoying. And they close those gaps, kind of like the Syracuse zone did for the most part, even against all the teams they've played, which is, you know, like, guys are going to get, Kespin's going to get a shot, right? He'll get a chance to shoot a three. But how long does that opportunity to actually get a clean look is very limited against the Trojans, but the Trojans are going to have to show up on offense. This is going to, like, the more points are scored, we said this a couple of times in football games, right? The more points are scored, the less chance the team has to win. That's for USC. This game gets into the 80s, even though they dropped 80 on Oregon, or the 90s, this turns into a track meet. I like Gonzaga a lot. It's going to be a tough team to beat, but with the limited amount of time, that length can be a real problem for Gonzaga. I'm super curious about this matchup because I've been really high in USC.
You know, you got every right to, Jerry. I mean, they're playing great ball at the right time of the year, and never underestimate that. That is, if kids start believing that they can win, and that if they can start playing, that is a great motivator in college basketball. You know, you hit a few threes, all of a sudden you get that mojo going. They could easily, you know, punch. And how many games is you know, the old question is how many games has Gonzaga played from behind? If I remember correctly, it's only been a couple. They've always been a front leading kind of team. So if USC were to come out with a 15-2 early run or something like that, that could really cause some tension, I think, for Gonzaga. I just think Gonzaga's got better talent, but you know, you hit a few shots and a few things go your way. Momentum's a hard thing to stop sometimes, you know, no matter how many timeouts you use as a coach.
Yeah. But this Gonzaga team is very talented. I think that is a point that, for all the people who do not trust Gonzaga this year, right? This is not like you're Adam Morrison and figure it out from there. You have 3 to 4 guys. It's just, and one thing that really impressed me in that Creighton game was Creighton, I felt like gave Gonzaga everything they could, right? If this was a boxing match, they threw all the haymakers and Gonzaga got right back up and just threw harder punches. That second half was a real show to that, because what else is Creighton supposed to do? Was kind of what I was thinking while I was watching it. I'm like, they're fighting for every rebound. They're hitting tough shots. And it's still Gonzaga would just go down the floor, get a quick rebound, have a great fast break, quick two, right? They start really doubling up on the line, the three-point line, drop down to Timmy. He just makes a great, you know, finish. It's a tough team to bet against, and they really do have talent. Something that even when they play that weaker West Coast Conference schedule, which has always been the knock on Gonzaga, and rightfully so, it's not been that they've played a weak schedule and they've been inflated. They've got some players, and they've got three guys that could go in the NBA draft, right? Jalen Suggs is like the number three prospect, at least from a lot of draft boards. And you can argue he's not the best player on that team. And I think that is like their leaps and bounds talent-wise that compared to other teams this year. I've been really impressed with them. But do we want to move on to probably one of the more surprising games, Michigan-Florida State? Do we have anything else we want to add before we get to that game?
Nah, it's going to be a fun one to watch. I'm going to, you know, I'll be intrigued.
And I think that the Michigan-Florida State game is supposed to be more of a fun game to watch, but it ended up not really being a great watch game because one thing that we talked a lot about with Florida State, it's been the best and worst thing at the same time, was they were 9-10 deep with no superstar. This is like the early Nuggets NBA teams that had a lot of good talent, but not like a superstar. Now that you can argue that differently, but like this really killed them because nobody really took over for Florida State. And it felt like as soon as Michigan had like a quick run or two, nobody picked up the ball and said, I'm getting a bucket on this possession. Scotty Barnes did go out early a bit with an ankle injury. He did come back. It's been something that's been nagging him all year, but nobody really stepped up. And that was the one thing you always worried about with Florida State all year, no matter who they were playing, right? Was what happens when Raekwon Gray, who has a good matchup, doesn't drop 15 like he's supposed to? What happens if Scotty Barnes, granted he was hurt this game for a bit, doesn't take advantage of his matchup? And nobody took advantage of some of the matchups they had in their favor. And Michigan did. You know, Michigan came out and they were consistent. I have to give them a lot of credit. Both me and Alex are pretty low on the Wolverines, but they have just found a way, including guys like Eli Brooks, who I've been really impressed with, just slugging it out. And remember, Juwan Howard was a player for a Lenard Hamilton team, right? He was coached by him. So that was he wants to talk about generational changes here. You're watching a great coach in Juwan Howard who's really figured it out. Man, they played really good, but I'm still in trust the Wolverines. Is there a reason I should be thinking that way?
You know, Jaron, I'm going to say this. This is only because I just think, you know, in terms of talent, man, that front line at Michigan is just scary. They're young, and they could do some really scary things. Who's the guy whose brother played for him? And you guys are much better with names. This
Mo
is
Wagner. What I admit. And from Wagner.
I'm telling you, if Wagner kid gets it going, they're unstoppable. I mean, because he can take you out. He can take you in. He can drop it off to that big freshman. I don't think, they're going to have an answer for him. I mean, if he is, he's going to be the key to the game for me. And I think Michigan just has better talent. UCLA, I've always been a big fan of, but I mean, it's that he impresses the hell out of me. And I think they should run the offense to that kid because he can play, you know?
Yeah. And I agree completely, Jerry. You and I, you know, have said that on multiple occasions that when Dickinson, the big man in the middle for them, when he's playing good, when he's playing well, I mean, they are a hard team to beat because he's a guy who's capable of scoring 20, 25 points. And I think you're right. I'm not sure exactly how well UCLA could potentially match up with him. But going back to that game against Florida State, unfortunately, was just a victim of going cold at the wrong time because they came into the tournament shooting about 40% from the three-point line. They made 0 three-pointers in their first game against UNCG. They shot about 33% in their second ball game and then shot 25% against Michigan. And I think this was some of the best basketball I've seen Michigan play top to bottom. They ran the ball through the middle of their offense. They got to the basket really well. They rebounded. They defended again against the Florida team that just could not get it going on offense. And I think that you're right. I think that it's all about Wagner and Dickinson inside because Wagner's just going to be a matchup problem because he's physical enough to where he can play inside. I mean, in that last game, he did knock down any threes, but he ended up with 13 points and 10 rebounds. You know, you don't get that by playing soft, right? So I think that it could potentially be a matchup problem. I think, you know, if we want to just go ahead and kind of transition into UCLA, I really think it's going to have to be Cody Riley guarding the big man in the middle. To me, the impact player for UCLA has got to be Jaime Jaquez. He's a guy who just always seems to step up when Juzang fouled out and was really in foul trouble the entire game last night for UCLA. And what was probably game of the night against Alabama, they won that one 88-78 in overtime. He was the guy who was really able to carry them down the stretch. Before we talk about that game too much, one thing, again, kind of a theme that we saw from a couple of games, there was a lot of bad offense in that game, a lot of isolation, a lot of NBA type stuff that I just personally hate. You know, there was multiple possessions in a row where neither team makes a single pass. You know, neither team makes a single pass outside of like the inbound. It's just a lot of dribbling. And then it's either a step back three or they try and go to the basket, do something. You know, they try and do something like that. Alabama, I think, was really fortunate to be in that ball game just because they shot significantly below 50% from the free throw line, which, you know, as a basketball purist, that's inexcusable. You know, I mean, a free throw is a shot that all three of us can make, you know, and so the fact that you've got these guys that do nothing but play basketball all the time, can't make a free throw, it is just, I just hate, it just drives me insane. You know, and then Alabama just did not pass the ball very well. Yeah, no, you look in the whole game, they made 30 shots. They had 9 assists. That's pathetic. You know, you got to move the ball if you want to win, especially late in the year.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the reasons we've been pretty low on Michigan this year, right, or at least in the tournament, was the loss of Isaiah Livers, right? And we were like, oh, what is that going to do to the Wolverines? Well, how about that happens to Alabama? Oh, wait, it did, with Herbert Jones getting those two fouls 41 seconds into the game. That was absolutely massive. And you talked a bit about the free throw shooting, Alex. I think you would appreciate my note that I put in there. And I go, it felt like Rutgers was playing this game for the Crimson Tide with their free throw shooting, but
looked like it.
It really did. And I was really impressed by a couple of things. First of all, UCLA, in the time that Herbert Jones went out, they hit shots. They took advantage of the fact that the best defensive player on Alabama's team was out, which is the thing that made the 3-point shooting, which is, I always like, the live, you die by the three. You know, this is a 10-point game without your best defensive player. You have Herbert Jones in this game, it's a totally different sense, right? They really took advantage of the fact that the one time Alabama's 3-point shooting and defense was off, they scored. You talked about, again, free throw shooting, free throw shooting, free throw shooting. This is a 10-point game. They went 11 from 25 from the free throw line. That's huge, right? And with Jumanji getting out, all the momentum for that overtime should have been with the Crimson Tide, which I have to give credit to UCLA. They stuck in that game. They hit some threes. They had a little bit of tournament magic. I'm not going to say like the Bruins were, you know, I got to give them credit, right? Like, I remember the 1-3 Jumanji hit. He just pump faked the dude. Guy went up in the air. He tried to get the foul. Didn't get the call.
Made it anyway.
And yeah. Like, sometimes, yeah, you know, that was, yeah, you know, that sometimes was kind of... when you're Nate Oates, you look at that play and you go, what else am I supposed to do? Right. Am I supposed to swarm him with my hands? Am I supposed to go out there as a sixth dude? You can't, you know, like, you got to give UCLA some credit here. They hit some shots and they made some plays that was like, wow. Okay. They kept themselves in it. And the thing about Alabama is their defense wasn't there. And that killed because the 3-point shooting, which was up, down, side to side, wasn't there either. And it was supposed to be a balancing act, which is, okay, if we're not hitting our shots, we could defend. That's why you were really high on them, Alex. And that's why I was a little more skeptical, was they could defend. They could defend. Well, they took out their best defender with those two quick fouls, and that changed the course of this game. The Bruins just impressed me, though, with the fact that they stuck with it. They stuck in it. And you know what they did? They got a lead. You know what's really hard to do? Come back. Yes, Alabama hit that crazy three, right, to get us into overtime, but you're running out of gas, you know? It was at 1.4, I think, when they went into halftime, it was like 40-29. Well, now you got to make that up. You know, now you have to put in the extra effort to get the stops on defense to then try to get the scores on offense. And it was a perfect storm of the things that Alabama couldn't have happened, which felt like an impenetrable force being impenetrated by, of course, LA basketball.
Well, I'm going to throw a little wrench into this one. This is the thing that you guys, I think, are missing a little bit here. You know, Alabama's philosophy and the head coach at Alabama, but Mick Cronin at UCLA is a damn good coach. He was a great coach in Cincinnati. This is a guy who knows the game. He's gone into arguably one of the toughest places to go and coach in UCLA, because I remember UCLA when Wooden was there. Yeah, I'm that old. But, you know, that the expectations, Alex, would be similar to like having to be the head football coach at Texas. You know, that guy is a great coach. He has gotten these guys playing at a different level. UCLA last year was the hottest team going into the NCAA tournament, and everybody kind of forgot about him. Cronin, you know, Cronin is a great coach. He's getting the maximum out of his players. They're playing his kind of ball like he did at Cincinnati. And I really think Alabama just, you know, when you live or die in that three, you know, you open yourself up. And the thing about when you do three ball is you get long rebounds and you get breakouts and you get layups, and UCLA just took them apart on stuff like that. And you got to give that. That's, you know, when you shoot too many threes, that can happen to you. And I think Cronin is really, I think, one of the better coaches in the field left. And people aren't really, you know, giving him his due.
So. Well, yeah, and it's because people forget about it, because it's the same thing happened last year. You know, UCLA last year started off slow, and people were like, wow, man, we're not sure, because I'm with you. I think Mick Cronin's a great coach, and he started off a little bit slow this year as well. But, man, when it gets close to tournament time, when it comes into March, he's a phenomenal coach, and you see it, because I'm with you. UCLA was one of the hottest, if not the hottest team going into the tournament last year, and if they would have had it, because UCLA was playing good ball. And – you know, and with Alabama, you know, it's one thing to shoot a lot of three-pointers, but one of the easiest shots to defend is when you inbound the ball, walk it, you know, 60 feet down the floor, and then you dribble in front of one person, you don't move, and you take just a three-pointer with 8 seconds left on the shot clock. That's not hard to defend. You're not making any sort of move. You're not getting any sort of ball movement. And Alabama, their whole season, it's like they, you know, they took good shots. They worked the ball around and got, you know, maybe a drive and a kick for an open three-pointer. That's an entirely different ball game, because Alabama knocks down open threes. They just didn't take any because they weren't passing the ball. They were just playing a very dribble heavy, you know, the ball was sticking and they just didn't move the ball. And UCLA took advantage of that. You're right. They got out on the rebounds, got some easy buckets, and they did move the ball around a little bit more than Alabama and got some open looks.
And you guys cannot see it on our Zoom, but right now we have actually done to a cutaway of Mick Cronin's dad in the stands, just in case you forgot he was at the game today. That just like the broadcast itself. But yeah, I think part of it too is that with Alabama, I'm going to keep going on that point, is it really hurt to lose Herbert Jones in this game for the extended amount of time that he did? Because the yin and yang of what Alabama was, yes, you could shoot tons of threes, but they also defended. But then you don't have your best defender, but also a guy who would facilitate the movement. Herbert Jones was the SEC player of the year, but only the fourth best scorer on the team, right? You usually think of player of the year, oh, he was dropping 25. No, but he was one of those guys that made a lot of things move. He was the gear. He was an important gear in the machine that Nate Oates was trying to run. And I think Mick Cronin took advantage of that, right? I think Seth Davis made a great point in the halftime show. He goes, yeah, they're like 7 for 15 for three, UCLA was, when Herbert Jones was out. And that wasn't a coincidence. And that's something that's so huge, I think, in that game. Now, we have four games the next 2 days, and we've already kind of previewed some of them, so we're going to try to make this a little quick here. I'm going to give you guys the times, and between Alex and my dad, you guys get to pick your favorite game. Give me one thing you're looking forward to, and we'll go from there. The four games we were talking about. First, number 12, Oregon State goes up against number 2, Houston. That's today, 3:29 on CBS at 6:15. Right after them, the Baylor Bears go up against the number 3, Arkansas Razorbacks. That's also today on 3:29. That's on CBS as well. It's supposed to be an 8:57 tip-off, barring a triple overtime game. Tuesday, you have the Zags, number 1, Gonzaga Bulldogs, going up, you know, against the number 6, USC Trojans. That's on TBS this Tuesday, 3:30 at 6:15. This is all Central Time, by the way. I should mention that. And then number 1, Michigan Wolverines go up against the number 11, UCLA Bruins. They also go up tip on Tuesday, 3:30, TBS, 8:57 as well. Alex, I'll let you go first because you're first on my screen. Out of those four games, which one are you most intrigued in and why?
Well, I really think that this Elite Eight slate that we have today and tomorrow, it really has something for everyone, because it's really whatever style of game that you like. I personally like more of the all-around game, and so I'd go with Baylor and Arkansas, because it's a team with a really, really good offense against a team with a great defense. If you like a super defensive game, you know, two teams that may not be prolific offenses, you've got Houston and Oregon State. You really like offense, you've got the best offensive team in the country taking on USC, who can also put up some points. And if you like watching Virginia for some reason, and you like teams that slow it down, they're going to work in the half court, you're not going to see a lot of fast breaks, you've got, you know, two of the slower teams left in the tournament in Michigan and UCLA. But going with Baylor, like we kind of established, it's going to be a matchup of the front court of Baylor And then we'll have to see if the younger guys from Arkansas out in the backcourt, you know, the guard play for Arkansas, most notably Moses Moody, see how they're going to be able to manufacture some offense against a tough Baylor squad. It wouldn't surprise me at all to see Davion Mitchell or Jared Butler on Moody throughout the game. They're both phenomenal defenders, but I would stick Mitchell on him because Mitchell is just, again, he's just a different beast out there when he's on defense. He's got quick hands, quick feet, can block shots. It's really hard to get around him. And so I like Baylor in this ball game just because, again, I like Baylor. They're, you know, as far as teams in the tournament, A&M's always pretty bad in basketball. So they're one of my kind of adopted teams that I have also being from the area. And I like the way that they're playing. And I think that this game against Arkansas, if they can get out and get up and run up and down with Arkansas a little bit and get the legs under them and start knocking down some shots, this could potentially be a turning point for Baylor's offense and see if they could get back clicking to how they were pre-COVID pause. But it's going to be a great game regardless.
Alex, secretly a Waco native. Dad, give me your favorite. We got three more games left on this Elite Eight slate. What's your favorite game and why?
Probably it's going to be the Michigan-UCLA game. Because, like I said, I like what Nick Cronin's doing with UCLA. They're a hot team. They're playing, some teams have a lucky horseshoe, and it looks like UCLA does. And I'm intrigued with Michigan. You know, I see mostly Michigan games because, you know, living in Chicagoland here, we see a lot of Big Ten basketball. And so, I'm more familiar with that. And I, like I said, I love the Wagner kid. I love the big kid in the middle for Michigan. I just think they've got a lot of weapons. And it's going to be Cronin's coaching against Michigan's athleticism, I think, is going to be an interesting battle there. And so for me, that's the game I'm probably most familiar with because my Ramblers are out. So I have to at least go somewhat Midwest. So,
well, I'm glad you guys didn't steal the game I'm most interested in, which is Gonzaga, USC. These are two teams I was very high on, right? Alex could tell you, he was like, yeah, I don't know about the Pac-12. And then he forgot Bill Walton existed. So that hurt his bracket a little bit, helped mine. But man, I've been really high on the Zags. I have them winning it all in my bracket personally, but it's because of that offensive attack and they do have some length. But if there's a team that's going to be able to catch them off guard, at least at this point, this is the best chance for USC to knock off the Bulldogs. Because if they're going to try to win a championship, they're going to have to run through them. So there's not much better opportunity you get to go against a team that's so offensively capable like Gonzaga, which means you have 48 hours to prep for them. You already know who the players are. You know that they could score both in and out. It's now, can you use your length? Can the Mobleys give Timmy a problem? Can you have guys who can close out and force Kespit to maybe pass out of a three? And just speed up Gonzaga. Grant, they're good speed-wise, too. I'm just very intrigued because these are two teams that have played very, very well. And also, this is going to be a real test for Gonzaga. Like, granted, we've said, like, oh, they don't play anybody, and they've had some tests throughout the season. I'm also just been a bit, you know, a Gonzaga truther for some reason. This is a really good test for the Bulldogs. And I think if they come out and they play like they did against Creighton, if they have a second half where they just expose whatever they want to on USC, it's only going to give me more reason to be bullish. So it makes sense. We left one game on the table, and that's one game that is going to be boring and painful. Number 12, Oregon State versus number 2, Houston. We've already kind of went through this, right? Length, slow, defensive. Anything else we want to add on this game? That's the first game of the tournament, too. So anything else we need to add?
I just think Houston's got, you know, they got some speed. I was impressed. I thought they got up and down the court a little. And so, I mean, in basketball, you know, like any sport, speed kills a little. And I'm just, I think they can move it up and down there. They've got some bounce too. They can rebound real well. They've got athletes who can bounce off the floor pretty fast. You know, that's the thing that impresses. And again, Samson's a great coach. I mean, he's kind of flying under the radar a lot of ways in terms of that.
Yeah. Great coach. To me, it's going to come down to, you know, who is going to step up for Oregon State and make some shots against a very tough team. Most points that Houston's allowed so far in the tournament is 60. Baskets are going to be hard to come by. I'm looking at Ethan Thompson, leading scorer for the Beavers, averaging 16 points a game. They're going to need to get it going, and ball movement is going to be paramount against Houston because they're going to defend, and Houston is a team that's capable of knocking down shots. Of course, you got the former Kansas Jayhawk, Quentin Grimes, leading the way. He's been playing big down the stretch, both on offense and on defense. He averages just about 18 points a game for him. And he's a guy that can just flat out play. He can knock down shots. And if he gets loose in this ball game, I actually think that Houston could potentially run away with it. You've got to see if Oregon State's able to, much kind of like UCLA, if they're able to kind of ride the momentum. I think that UCLA, I think we can all agree, probably has, compared to Oregon State, the coaching advantage as far as moving on. I also think that UCLA, that Michigan might be a better matchup for UCLA than Houston is, because Houston can knock down threes. Michigan struggles to shoot the three, especially with Livers out. To me, going back, you know, just kind of jumping back to that Michigan-UCLA game, that's going to be the difference in the ball game to me, is can they get the ball down low, kick it out, and then knock down that three from the far side. If UCLA can force Michigan into those types of shots and force them to take some three-pointers, it could be a little bit, it could be a little bit dicey, because again, they're not a team that shoots the ball incredibly well from the outside on a consistent basis. But if one of their guys gets hot, it, again, by the same token, they could run away with it as well, much like Houston.
Absolutely. And honestly, there's a lot of great points, and really we have four great games left to watch in this tournament. One that's been taking us back and forth. And really the whole time we've learned it's just about the Pac-12, and that's all. That's all it is. Pac-12 is just really college basketball. Dad, thank you for popping by to film a podcast with us. Again, now you have to listen to yourself, so good luck doing that. It's really hard to do.
Yeah, it's hard to they'll be kind of scary on the ride on the expressway home from school, so it's going to be fun. Alex, this has been a joy. I've heard you. Now I got to see you. It's been a real pleasure. Yeah.
Now we just have to set up the mini golf game, so... Again, thank you, Dad, for popping by. We're going to try to do something Thursday, but Wednesday or Thursday, after these great Elite Eight games, we're going to talk about the Final Four and maybe some coaching changes as well. We have some, you know, maybe I have to bring on my mom for that Shaka Smart Marquette game, you know, move. That was pretty big. But thank you guys again. We're going to be going on hopefully Wednesday or Thursday. And if not, enjoy your Elite Eight games. This has been Walking the Field. Jerry Hopkins, Alex Crow, and special guest Steve Hopkins. Till next time. Peace.